The Story Behind the Headlines, presented by the American Historical Association in cooperation with the National Broadcasting Company, with Caesar Searchinger. Each week, Mr. Searchinger, noted foreign correspondent, writer, and radio commentator, discusses the dominant news event, either in our own country or abroad, and sketches the historical background leading up to it. This evening, Mr. Searchinger's subject is the federal income tax. Ladies and gentlemen, Caesar Searchinger brings you the story behind the headlines.
Hello, everybody. It is a sad commentary on the present state of the world when the only cheerful news is about the income tax. Income tax yields 18% above 1937, was the headline that smiled at me from the front page yesterday morning. The rest of the headlines were headaches. And as we've heard enough about the headaches all day, let's talk about the subject we were all interested in a few days ago, the federal income tax. The interest we took in it wasn't the same with all of us, perhaps. With some of us, it was certainly what you might call absorbing. But with most of us, it was purely platonic. For, believe it or not, although we heard a lot of people talking about it, only a very small proportion of the population actually pay federal income tax. Would you like to know how many? Well, we don't know about this year yet, but in 1936, on the basis of records compiled in 1937, tax returns were filed by 5,447,000 people. In other words, one out of every 24 citizens actually pays a federal income tax. Or, supposing every person earning a living has four others depending on him, it would still be less than one out of every five citizens, counting man, woman, and child, that is directly affected by the federal income tax. Now, that doesn't mean that only 20% of the families in the United States pay for running the government. In good times, federal income tax produces about two-thirds of the country's tax revenue. In 1936, it was only one-third, the other two-thirds being derived from import duties, excise duties of various sorts, a whole variety of taxes to which we all more or less contribute. One thing that's worth remembering about them is that all of them, with the exception of the estate duty, or inheritance tax, and the gift tax, they all fall on rich and poor alike, while the income tax tries to distribute the burden according to people's ability to bear it. That is the important difference between direct and indirect taxes. The indirect tax hits people regardless of their ability to pay. The direct tax, or income tax, tempers the wind to the shorn lamb. It may seem curious that the United States, the most democratic country in the world, should be the last of the great nations to have adopted direct taxation. The reasons are to be found in our peculiar constitution as a federal state, in the nature of the country when it was founded, in our original aversion to centralized government. The early history of our central government is a struggle for general recognition, and this is closely tied up with the history of taxation, for the main purse strings were in the hands of the states. Congress had only the right of indirect taxation, for its direct taxes had to be apportioned by population, and the interpretation and modification of that right makes up much of the history of federal taxation in the United States. Originally, the United States government depended on import duties and revenue from the sale of unsettled land for its modest expenses. Excise duties, that is, taxes on the manufacture of commodities, were traditionally despised since the days of British rule. So throughout the history of the United States, they were resorted to almost only in times of war or economic stress. Import duties nobody minded, because it was thought that they were paid by the foreigner anyway. Alexander Hamilton, our first Secretary of the Treasury, induced Congress to levy a tax on whiskey, and thereby brought a storm about his ears. Whiskey was then considered a daily necessity, and a tax on it unjust. You probably remember something about the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. Well, that was a protest against the tax. Nevertheless, as time went on, taxes on spirituous liquors and tobacco became the most profitable of all excise duties, and we have stuck to them as the backbone of our internal commodity taxation ever since 1794, when they were reimposed. By that time, however, Hamilton had added taxes on sugar refining, snuff, carriages, and auction sales, and a stamp tax on legal transactions soon followed. But even by 1800, the whole internal revenue was less than $1 million, think of it, while the total ordinary budget was nearly $11 million, almost covered by customs duties. In 1802, excise taxes were swept away because they were thought undemocratic and because they involved prying into people's business. But, as I said, they were reimposed every time we had a war, and each time they were kept until opposition became too strong. The only thing that permanently stuck after the Civil War was liquor and tobacco. Until the Civil War, internal taxes weren't very important anyway. Then, for the first time, they compared in volume with the customs duties. Customs duties became bigger and bigger, of course, not only because more things were imported as the country grew richer, but because import duties acted as a protection to our own growing industries. Infant industries, they were called in those days. So, during the last half of the 19th century, we swore by protective duties as the source of prosperity and, incidentally, high prices. But by 1914, when we had to fight another major war, excise taxes were imposed in such quantities that for the first time they actually surpassed import duties in volume. And yet they weren't the biggest source of revenue because something revolutionary in our financial history had happened, namely the imposition of income tax by virtue of the 16th Constitutional Amendment, adopted in 1913. Now, that was just 25 years ago, so many of us can remember the halcyon days when there was no federal income tax at all. We paid our taxes in one way and another whenever we went to the grocery store or to the shoe store or to the clothing store, and we paid them cheerfully because we didn't realize we were paying them. We didn't realize it because they were indirect taxes, the painless kind, as we thought. But were they? If you had to pay 2 cents more for every pound of sugar than you would have to pay if there wasn't an import duty or an excise tax hidden in the price, it might seem painless, on the principle that what you don't know doesn't hurt you, but actually it was making housekeeping more expensive, and the poorer you were, the more you were suffering without being able to spot the cause. Of course, more and more people had begun to realize that direct taxation was more equitable and benevolent than the indirect method. But they had a hard uphill fight to get it on the statute books, the reason being the old ingrained prejudice against direct taxes as expressed in the Constitution of the United States. But what did the Founding Fathers mean by the word direct? Modern authorities are pretty well agreed that what they had in mind was a direct tax on a man's land. The citizens of our early farmer democracy simply didn't wish to hand Congress the right to tax their land. They thoroughly believed in states' rights, and state governments were closer to home. Now observe what happened about the income tax. For the first 70-odd years of the Union, no direct taxation was actually imposed. Then came the Civil War. In wartime, as we all have reason to know, many things are done that normally might not be considered legitimate. So when the U.S. Congress needed more and more money to carry on the war, it passed an Internal Revenue Act which included many new duties, of which income duty was one. It consisted of a 3% tax on incomes over $600 and 5% on amounts above $10,000. The yield was small, so 2 years later the rates became stiffer, 5%, 7.5%, and 10% on anything over $10,000. After some further changes, the law lapsed in 1873. Now here's a curious commentary on public opinion. 20 years after the American people stopped paying the Civil War income tax, there was a considerable outcry at the very suggestion of a small tax upon incomes derived from certain corporate investments, which was voiced by President Cleveland in his message of 1893. And when Congress in the following August actually passed an income tax on the old Civil War lines to stop a hole in the budget, it was due chiefly to the votes of the South and West, where people didn't have much money income but depended on the resources of their land. The industrial states looked upon it simply as class legislation, a bid for the votes of the poor by discriminating against the rich. The rich, by the way, with no rising scale at all, paid 2% flat, and that included everybody making over $4,000 a year. But the bill had one prophetic innovation. It classified all property acquired by gift or inheritance as income. Also, it taxed income from land, real estate. The objections to the bill were shared in a most important place, namely the Supreme Court. And you may not be surprised to know that the law didn't become effective before it was declared unconstitutional, notably in the celebrated case of Pollock versus the Farmers Loan and Trust Company. Pollock, a citizen of Massachusetts, alleged that the payment of income tax by the trust company decreased the value of his shares and was unconstitutional on various grounds. Well, the court had a hard time making up its mind. It held only some parts of the law unconstitutional and had a rehearing. Then, in 1895, it declared the law unconstitutional. It said that a tax on income from land was a direct tax, that a tax on income from personal property was a direct tax, and a tax on state and city bonds was a tax on the borrowing powers of the state, and therefore void. So the act was dead, and the decision largely turned on the old interpretation of the word direct, now regarded as an error. But for the first time, the court was divided on the question of direct taxation, 5-4, and the dissenting opinions were so brilliant as to strengthen public sentiment in favor of income tax. Nevertheless, the court stuck to its guns while there was much discussion in Congress. Finally, President Taft proposed a compromise in his message to Congress in 1899. He said that the only proper course was by way of a constitutional amendment, which then actually came to pass in 1913. After a unanimous resolution in the Senate and only 14 dissenting votes in the House had put it before the country. So you see how a constitutional principle, which may have nothing to do with the object of a law, can impede legislation until public opinion in its favor becomes overwhelming. That there was never any ethical objection to income tax as such, you can gather from the fact that some individual states had income taxes as far back as 1840, and the so-called faculty taxes of the American colonies amounted to the same thing. And these faculty taxes, by and by, became our early state taxes. But these state taxes didn't yield much. They were crude, locally administered. Modern state income tax dates from the Oklahoma Professional Income Tax of 1908, and the first really centrally administered efficient income tax was that of Wisconsin, adopted in 1911 with progressive rates and the familiar exemptions. Its framer was Professor Thomas S. Adams, and he was afterwards called to Washington to assist in making the federal income tax work. To him, more than any other man, goes the credit for being the spiritual father of our modern income tax administration, though I don't know that there have been many statues erected in his honor. Now, all income tax laws have become more and more complicated as time went on, and ours is no exception. But there is one consolation for you. The complications are the result of constant effort at a more equitable distribution of the load. So next time you struggle with your income tax form, you can at least feel that you are doing your bit for social justice in this intricate, modern setup called the state. Goodbye, and to my European listeners, good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another in the series of programs presenting the story behind the headlines, as told by Caesar Searchinger, noted foreign correspondent, writer, and radio commentator. This program, presented by the American Historical Association, will discuss the outstanding news event of each week. Copies of these talks are available in printed form. They are issued by the Columbia University Press in the form of a bulletin, which also includes additional material and bibliography. They may be had for 10 cents apiece by addressing the story behind the headlines, NBC Radio City. Copies of last week's talk on England's foreign policy are also available for 10 cents, or the entire series may be had for $1. Write to the story behind the headlines, NBC New York. Next week, Mr. Searchinger expects to discuss America's foreign policy with respect to Europe. This is an NBC educational feature. This is the National Broadcasting Company.